From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. The U.S. Sentencing Commission voted this month to cut prison time for those convicted of federal drug crimes. What's the process for getting these sentences shortened, and how many Maryland inmates could be affected? We asked James Wyda, the federal public defender in Maryland. Then, what can a Confederate soldier's simple drawings tell us about life at Point Lookout, the Union's prisoner of war camp at Maryland's southern tip? We ask historian Ross Kimmel, who co-authored a book that answers that question. Plus, two brunettes, Tom Hall and Jaywin Russick, discuss Legally Blonde, the musical, now at the Community College of Baltimore County, Essex. And Tom talks with author Clorinda Harris about the quirky, pointedly Baltimore characters who populate her short story collection, The White Rail. First News.
I'm producer Jamila Kay. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock. That's on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming at WIPR.org. Now, on with the show.
Thanks, Nathan. This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. This month, the U.S. Sentencing Commission voted unanimously to reduce the sentences of as many as half of the 100,000 people serving time for federal drug crimes, crimes like manufacturing, distributing, or possessing with intent to distribute, or acting as a principal administrator, organizer, or leader of a continuing criminal enterprise. Several hundred of those federal prisoners are from Maryland. The commission's vote means those prisoners are eligible to have their sentences reviewed by a judge who may cut their sentence. The commission already had voted to reduce the sentences of future drug offenders. What impact could this have on inmates from Maryland, and when could we start seeing reductions in sentences? With us on the line to discuss this situation is James Wyda, federal public defender for the District of Maryland. James Wyda, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Now, what particular federal drug crimes is this change meant to address?
This will really cover, you know, all federal drug distribution crimes, sort of across the board, all types of drugs and you know, the various mechanisms by which they're distributed that you outlined in your introduction. It's really a broad array of drug crimes.
And how many Maryland residents could be affected by this decision?
The estimates right now are that there'll be up to approximately 800. I think we're still, in the process of finalizing and comparing those lists. But you know, the guess is it'll be less than 1,000, somewhere around 800.
And these, I should clarify my own question. Is that inmates in federal facilities in Maryland, or is that people who hail from Maryland?
Sure, it's folks that have been prosecuted and convicted and sentenced in the federal courts in Maryland, predominantly Maryland residents, most of them probably serving their sentences at facilities outside of Maryland because of the scarcity of federal prisons in Maryland.
So not every federal drug inmate is guaranteed release or reduction. Who is eligible, and how will the process work?
So it's nationally, this is quite a major change in our sentencing practice in federal court. This is part of a trend to bring some reduced severity in our federal sentencing process for drug crimes. Folks are, there's a sense that these sentences have been too severe and too costly for too long. So the process in Maryland will be starting in November of 2015 is the first time that individuals can start to get their sentences reduced. This was put in place so that all the parties, the Department of Justice, U.S. probation, the courts, and the defense function, primarily my office, can get ready to address these. As you mentioned in your introduction, these will be resentencings. So ultimately, a judge will make the decision as to whether the individual is eligible and deserving of the reduction. But again, just about everybody prosecuted and sentenced for a drug distribution crime will be brought back for a resentencing, and ultimately it will be a judge making the decision as to whether the individual is deserving of the reduction.
will the defendant or the inmate need to, what will he or she need to show? Or is it just a matter of showing up and saying, hey, I should be eligible for a smaller sentence?
I think that's a little bit unclear right now. Again, I think the initiative from the commission is, the hope is that these sentences were simply set too high by the sentencing guidelines. So I think the expectation is that most will receive these reductions. But based upon the individual's prior record, based upon their performance in prison, how they've adjusted, there may be a concern about public safety, and that's what this delay till November of 2015 permits, is for those to be raised. I don't expect that the individuals will be brought back. I think these will be primarily paper transactions. We've been through this before. Because there was reform brought to the crack sentencing guidelines a little bit over a year or two ago. And again, we dealt with a high number of individuals then. And again, I'm frankly pretty proud of our system in Maryland, both my office, the courts, probation, and the prosecutors sort of collaborating to make sure that these wrong sentences were righted, so to speak.
I want to pick up on a phrase you used before we move on. You said there's a feeling that these sentences have been too severe for too long. Am I right that a lot of that severity was triggered in the mid-'80s after the University of Maryland basketball star Len Bias died of a drug overdose?
I think, again, in the 80s, there was a notion that, the metaphor was we needed a war on drugs. Len Bias's death and a number of other sort of, sensational incidents sort of fed into that. There was a lot of fear and a lot of anxiety. And I think Americans thought that we could, incarcerate ourselves, our nation out of this, what's really sort of a social and medical problem. America now leads the world in incarceration. We have well over 2 million Americans in prison, and increasingly folks on both sides of the political spectrum, I think, have come to believe that these sentences are too severe and too costly for us to tolerate at this point. And it's a pretty exciting time in the criminal justice system. My sense is that we're changing our views of what is just in terms of our sentencing laws, and this is another important step in that process.
On 88.1, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass, speaking with James Wyda, federal public defender for the District of Maryland. We're talking about the U.S. Sentencing Commission's amendment to reduce sentences for some federal drug offenders. So how much time do you think we're looking at cutting from these sentences?
So it really depends a little bit on the individual. It depends maybe primarily on how much time they have remaining in their sentence. It could be as little as a few days. It could be as much as 3 years. The average sentence, according to the Sentencing Commission's data, is that they expect the sentences to be reduced to approximately 25 months per individual. Going back to the cost argument, they expect this to be more than 80,000 bed years. In terms of prisoners, a day in a prison bed costs approximately $165 a day. So this is going to save the taxpayers millions and millions of dollars.
Well, are you expecting that most of the inmates who come forward will essentially have already served their sentence, their newly reduced sentence? Are you expecting this to result in sort of instant, come November 2015, instant release?
I think for some, there will be prompt release, maybe instant release. Again, we've been through this a little bit before. What happened in Maryland was that our probation office did a very nice job of setting up what we call in the federal system supervised release for these individuals, so they don't quite go right off to the streets. They go into a fairly intensive supervision from the federal probation office where they get support in terms of adjusting into the community. The vast majority will be gradually released into the community the way they would normally be at the end of their sentence. That means going into a halfway house and gradually given more and more freedoms as they re-enter into the community. But I do suspect some. I think this needs to be worked out, but I do think some will promptly re-enter the community, perhaps accompanied by a probation officer as they do.
And your lawyers, the public defenders, are the lawyers for most of these inmates, correct?
Yes, we probably were from the beginning. We represent nearly 75% of the individuals prosecuted in federal court in Maryland, and I think the expectation is that we will do the lion's share of this work.
Am I correct, 19 attorneys?
Yep, that's how many we have after the sequester. We lost 14% of our staff during the sequester.
So do you have enough to do this work?
Yeah, we have a great office. I'm very proud of our people, and we probably won't receive additional resources, but we will prioritize based upon release date, who to address first, and people will just work harder because I think they're motivated to make sure that the right thing is done for these clients.
You mentioned a few minutes ago sort of a change in attitudes toward drug sentences. Are there implications for state courts? I mean, this decision does not directly affect sentences, drug sentences from Maryland state courts, but do you see some movement?
Yes. I think this will not affect, Maryland state drug sentences, but you've seen this type of change, this type of reform, at local levels, state levels, and the national levels. I think there's a growing sense that we have to sentence smarter, that we can't continue to sentence as crudely and as punitively as we have for the past few decades, and that we can do better, and that we need to do better.
And let me just make sure that I understand. There's a phrase that non-lawyers hear a lot, mandatory minimum sentences. Does this affect that?
This can affect that. There is legislation, exciting legislation before Congress right now to reform the mandatory minimums. That's what really needs to be changed in our justice system to really make a dramatic impact on the sentencing laws, especially the drug sentencing laws. This is a help, but the legislation in the Smarter Sentencing Act pending before Congress is the next big shoe to drop. And
we will check with you when that's happening.
Yeah, I love that. I love how you're following this story, and that would be great to keep an eye on.
Thanks so much for talking to us.
Great. Thanks so much.
James Wyda, the federal public defender for the District of Maryland. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass. Just ahead, a Confederate soldier's drawings take us inside a Maryland prisoner of war camp. Stay with us on 88.1.
Producer Jamila Kay. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Thanks for listening.
This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. It's the Civil War, the hot summer of 1864, 150 years ago. You're a private in the Confederate Army. You've been captured by the Union, and you're being held at Point Lookout, the North's biggest and southernmost prisoner of war camp at the tip of southern Maryland. What do you do? John Jacob Omenhauser's approach was to paint watercolors. Private Omenhauser described life as a prisoner of war not in a diary, but through pictures. Dozens of his drawings and letters have been collected into a book called I Am Busy Drawing Pictures, The Civil War Art and Letters of Private John Jacob Omenhauser. And with me to talk about it is Ross Kimmel, co-author of the book and retired chief historian for the Maryland Park Service. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
When did you first come across John Jacob Omenhauser's pictures?
When I was a teenager and had a budding interest in the Civil War, my father gave me a copy of American Heritage's then brand new picture history of the Civil War. And in the section on prison camps, there was a reproduction of a kind of crude watercolor cartoon attributed to John Omenhauser, painted at Point Lookout, of Confederate prisoners catching and cooking rats to eat to supplement their diet. That made an impression on me,
I guess.
And later, little did I know, I would grow up to be the historian for the Maryland Park Service, which has a large park, as you know, at Point Lookout. And one thing we were interested in doing was interpreting the life of soldiers in the prison camp. So I knew this picture was at the Maryland Historical Society. I went there and asked to see it. It was in a sketchbook with 43 other very interesting sketches of various aspects of what went on in the prison. So I put together a slide program to use at the park for programs for the public on what prisoners did at Point Lookout. And then over the years, my good friend Mike Music and I began to discover other examples of artwork that we were convinced was by the same guy, though many people attributed them to different people who were prisoners or guards at Point Lookout. And I think they were one-time owners, but not the artist. Other people disagree and think they're many artists.
Tell us about John Jacob Omenhauser.
He was born in Philadelphia in 1832. His parents were German immigrants who had married in Philadelphia in 1828. We don't know the circumstances of their immigration. He had an older sister. His father seems to have been in the food trades. He's listed as a butcher in the census of 1850. The family moved to Baltimore on Howard Street. Now, in his descendants' possessions are a couple of very interesting watercolor streetscapes of probably Baltimore townhouses and shops, one of which is actually identified as Howard Street. And there's also a portrait of a teenage boy, which may be him, maybe a self-portrait. We're not sure.
You are an historian, not an art critic, but how would you describe these drawings?
Well, I've seen plenty of drawings by Civil War artists, some professional and some folk. He's not the best, that's for certain. He may have had some rudimentary art training because some of his pictures show a familiarity with linear perspective. But what his pictures lack in artistic merit, they more than make up for in verisimilitude. I mean, you're there. He had a sardonic sense of humor, and most of his pictures are intended to be humorous. He makes the catching and eating of rats kind of a humorous thing. He was a very upbeat sort of guy in his letters. He's always talking about, oh, you always got to look to the bright side of life. And
yeah, when he was captured at Point
Lookout,
he immediately said, don't worry about me, I'm in good health.
Right. Well, most of his letters begin with that kind of thing, and most of Anne's letters to him, same sort of thing, because early death and sickness was so much more common then than it is now that people, first thing they wanted to know is, are you still alive? Are you well? And he got letters from home saying, well, so-and-so, my niece died, or so-and-so, my sister's husband died, this, that, and the other thing. He commented at one point that he knows more people who are dying outside of the Army than dying inside it.
On Maryland Morning, WYPR, I'm Sheila Cass speaking with historian Ross Kimmel. We're talking about a book he co-authored, I Am Busy Drawing Pictures, The Civil War Art and Letters of Private John Jacob Omenhauser. In 2013, producer Matt Purdy and I visited the site where the prisoner of war camp Point Lookout once stood. That's where John Jacob drew most of the pictures in the book. We spoke with Bob Krickenberger. He's a longtime volunteer ranger at what is now Point Lookout State Park. And I was struck by how many soldiers were crammed into Point Lookout at the time that Omenhauser was there. Here's what Krickenberger told us.
There would be upwards of 23,000 jammed in here by mid-64, 1864. Over 52,000 would pass through this gate in 2 years. They didn't expect that many to be through here.
What can Omenhauser's drawings tell us about what life was like in a prisoner of war camp?
Well, in the book, we were able to break his surviving Point Lookout pictures down into several categories. One that really fascinated me was prison economy. There was a very active method of exchange of goods and food, and the prisoners generally did not get adequate food from the Union authorities, so they had to scramble to get whatever else they could. And there was a lot of bartering that went on. prisoners would make use of whatever handicraft skills they had to make. And Oppenheimer draws pictures of these things, like fans and watch chains and jewelry and rings, to sell to other prisoners, to Yankee guards, to visiting civilians, whoever they could. The coin of the realm at Point Lookout turned out to be hardtack crackers and chews of tobacco. Everything was valued in these things, and soldiers would use these as a medium of exchange. Cooking was a preoccupation of John's. He was in the food preparation business as a civilian, and he liked to draw pictures of prisoners cooking and preparing food, even if it was rats. He also shows them steaming crabs that they got out of the Chesapeake Bay. The other thing that I find really interesting is, in an ironic turn of fate, there were several USCT, that is U.S. Colored Troop Regiments, that were sent to Point Lookout to perform guard duty, which was kind of reversal of the way things had been before the Civil War. And relations between the white Confederate prisoners and the black guards were not so good. And Oppenheimer drew a number of pictures showing the friction between the two races. He also showed pictures of things like gambling, swimming in the bay. The authorities would let them in good weather go out into the bay to swim and fish and wash their clothes. And unfortunately, the latrines were on piers at the end, were at the ends of piers out in the Chesapeake. So there were men relieving themselves into the other prisoners' bathwater and fishing water and things like that. And all of this can be corroborated by accounts, written accounts, by other people who were imprisoned at Point Lookout.
You write in the introduction about the Civil War, quote, "People instinctively understand that all American history that went before and all that has gone since has as its balance point four brief years in the early 1860s, close quote. How do these somewhat crude pictures illuminate those 4 years?
You know, he was selective in what he drew pictures of. Now, luck of the draw, he did not see a lot of combat, even though he was in the Civil War for 4 years. For political reasons, his unit was kept away from the main theaters of action until the very end, when the Union was closing in on Petersburg and Richmond. And then they really did start seeing some heavy combat, but he got captured at the beginning of all that. His pictures mostly dwell on camp scenes and things that are going on behind the lines, because that's where he spent most of the war, in and around Richmond, in and around Charleston, South Carolina. And that's what he chose to draw pictures of, the mundane aspects of Civil War life, which often gets overlooked. People prefer to the glamour of battles, quote-unquote glamour of battles, things like the prison experience and the mundane everyday sort of things the soldiers did tend to get overlooked. But that's what he illustrated for us.
What happened to Oppenheimer after the war?
Well, immediately after the war, he went from Point Lookout to Baltimore, where his mother and sister and his sister's family lived, to visit them. And he wrote his soon-to-be wife in Richmond, Anne. He said, I'm going there first. I will return to Richmond as soon as I can, but I've undertaken a job that I can't finish before the 4th of July. Now, what that job was, he doesn't say. Was it another sketchbook? We just don't know. But he did return to Richmond, and he married Anne Howell in 1866. They had several children, five, three of whom died in infancy, unfortunately. And the census of 1870 lists him as a candy maker. So he was in the food trades. He seems to have been tied in with caterers and liquor merchants and bottlers and restaurateurs. His first daughter married a restaurant owner. And then he died young at age 44 in 1877 of cancer. His wife, Anne, lived for another 40 years and never remarried.
I really appreciate your talking to us about
it. Sure. Thank you for having me.
Ross Kimmel. He is co-author with Michael Music of the book I Am Busy Drawing Pictures, The Civil War, Art and Letters of Private John Jacob Oppenheimer. The book is being published by the Maryland State Archives. We've got a link to where you can buy it on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. Ahead on Maryland Morning, quirky people in Baltimore populate Clarinda Harris's collection of short stories. Stay with us on 88.1.
I'm producer Jamila Kay. Go to our website to learn more about a segment you just heard, check out our audio archives, or to join in the conversation yourself. You can also make a pledge to support local programming like Maryland Morning. That's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. J. Wynn Russick, our theater critic, is with us as well. How are you doing, Judy?
Fine, Tom.
So you have been over to Cockpit and Court to see their new production of Legally Blonde, the musical. Now, of course, for a while, Legally Blonde was one of those movies was on every time you turned on the TV. So you have this ubiquitous movie. Was it Reese Witherspoon? Right?
Yes,
she was terrific in that movie.
Yeah, 2001, I think.
Yeah, so why should somebody see the musical?
Well, of course, Tom, the musical has songs. They're by Lawrence O'Keefe.
Oh, those.
And yes. Lawrence O'Keefe and his wife, Nell Benjamin, wrote the songs, and some of them are very clever. And you could also make the case that in the songs, the themes come across more strongly than they did in the screenplay. The songs reinforce themes like being true to yourself, which is really the show's central theme. And it's very well directed at Cockpit by Robert W. Opel, especially in the first act. It moves very swiftly from scene to scene. I'll give you an example. You must remember Legally Blonde is about a California sorority girl named Elle Woods, and she is, of course, blonde. And when her boyfriend dumps her because he's going off to Harvard Law School and he thinks that Elle is not serious enough, she decides to follow him.
She's sort of like a ditzy valley girl.
But that's what
type.
He thinks, yes, right. Yes. Mm-hmm. And there's a number early in the show when Elle decides that she's going to apply to Harvard Law School because, of course, she's not really ditzy. And the number is called What You Want. And it transitions very rapidly and very humorously and very smoothly from Elle's decision to apply to her hitting the books for the LSATs and then telling her parents and the reaction to her application at Harvard. And of course, whenever Elle is inspired or when she's discouraged, those are very large emotions and they give her a reason to sing. The title song starts out with one of her most discouraging moments when she's ready to throw in the towel out there in Boston and thinking of going back to Malibu.
Back to the sun, back to the shore.
That's Bridget Linzenmeyer and James Baxter. They're part of Cockpit and Court's production of Legally Blonde. So the show is a musical comedy, so I'm assuming that there's some dancing.
There is in every
self-respecting musical comedy. But most of the show, as you say, is set at the Harvard Law School. So those seem incongruous. Are there dancing law students? What happens?
Well, there are some dancing law students,
oh,
yes.
Oh, heaven forbid.
But it's mostly dancing by Elle's sorority sisters. One of the musical's funniest aspects is that in keeping with the idea of sororities, her sorority sisters form a Greek chorus, and they pop up to encourage her to stay positive. There are dancing cheerleaders. There's a river dance spoof at one point. There's a fitness expert who plays a very important role in the second act, and we see her exercise tape, which is called Whipped Into Shape, and she and the chorus dance and sing while they're jumping rope. And even Elle's law school essay to get in is a singing and dancing production number, an extravaganza. So there's lots of dancing, and it has very lively choreography at Cockpit by Vincent Musgrave.
Well, it looks like they found plenty of excuses to dance at Harvard Law School and elsewhere. So the last time you were here, we talked about a musical called Carrie, which had a cast of very young performers. I take it Legally Blonde does, too. How does this cast do at Cockpit?
Well, they do pretty well. Before I get to the youngsters, Tom, I wanted to say that there are some community theater stalwarts in the show. Tammy Opel, who plays a hairdresser whom Elle befriends, and John Desmond, who plays Elle's tough law school professor. And they both do very well in these character roles. But most of this cast is very young, and they do a good job with the show's energetic demands. The leads are both fresh faces to me. James Baxter, who plays Elle's eventual love interest, Emmett. We just heard a bit of him singing. But the success of Legally Blonde really depends on the actress who plays Elle. And Bridget Linzenmeyer has just the right sort of perky, can-do attitude. And she has a good, strong voice with very crisp diction.
Even if I crash and burn 10 times a day, I think I
really nice singing. That's Bridget Linsenmeyer singing the inspirational song Find My Way from Cockburn and Court's production of Legally Blonde. So, you know, it's a piece set in college and graduate school. It's clearly a good show for these young performers. How about young audiences?
Oh, I think it is very good for young audiences. This is an amateur production, of course, so the singing and the orchestra are not always on key. But the production has, what it has in spades really is spirit. And Legally Blonde is a musical about spirit. The script, which is adapted from the screenplay by Heather Hatch, emphasizes following your dreams and living up to your full potential, and especially not judging or being judged by appearances. They're all very good messages for young people. And, Tom, let's not forget the current front runner for the Democratic presidential nomination is a woman who's a lawyer and blonde.
There you go. Art imitates life. All right, Judy Russick, good to see you. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Tom.
Cockburn and Court's production of Legally Blonde, the musical, continues through Sunday. It's at the Essex campus of the Community College of Baltimore County. We've got all the details on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. It's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. Stay with us. On 881, it's Maryland Morning. Glad you're all with us this morning. I'm Tom Hall. It's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. We turn now to the poet Clorinda Harris. She's published 6 volumes of poetry, and more than 350 of her poems have appeared in journals and magazines. She was for 40 years a professor of English at Towson University, and she joins me this morning to talk about her latest book, in which she ventures once again into the world of short stories. It's called The White Rail. It's a collection of 6 stories that take place in and around Baltimore, and which introduce us to characters that include a scantily clad chef who displays herself in an abandoned department store window, a possibly homeless man who encounters a woman in her Guilford hot tub, 2 women with the same name, and a prisoner who becomes a big fan of Emily Dickinson. Clorinda Harris, it's good to see you again. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
So you, of course, are known far and wide as a poet, but you've been writing short stories all along, I guess. But this is your very first actual collection in a book.
Indeed.
So why the move from poetry back to short stories?
Well, not everything wants to be a poem. And also, my poems, even sonnets, I mean, even groups of haiku, there's always a narrative lurking in the background. I think I am essentially a storyteller. In the most formal of poems, or the least formal of poems. So storytelling is something I love.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes things don't want to be a poem that tells a story or where a story is lurking. They just want to be a flat-out story.
And is the mindset, the perspective, the prism in which you hew and craft the short stories, is that a very different endeavor than writing poems for you?
Yes and no. Very often I'll be working on a short story and a poem will simply interrupt and give me a little kick in the shins and say, excuse me, and
my turn.
Yeah, my turn. And it will be something that may have or may have nothing to do with the story itself. But very often there'll be an image or an idea that actually doesn't want to be in the story. It would make the story precious. But if I developed it as a poem, it would be something else altogether. So I used to think that one form of writing kind of detracted from another or got you using the wrong set of muscles. But the only kind of writing I've ever found that really does that is writing grant proposals. Oh my, that will kill your prose. It will kill your poetry. It will kill every spark of creativity you ever had in you, although you have to be pretty creative with it to convince Agency X that they really need to give you a whole bunch of money.
Sure.
But it's a form of creativity that just militates for me against any kind of other form of writing.
Now, poetry still plays a big role in this
absolutely.
Book. Some of the poems are imagined by your characters, and some are, you know, real poems, as it were, by, you know, established, published
right.
poems. And in a lot of ways, you seem to kind of lampoon the biz you're in of analyzing poetry and teaching poetry. I thought that was kind of fun.
I think if you take it too seriously, the fact that in reality it is your obsession goes around the bend, and instead of communicating it to the public or to your students, it simply becomes a sign that you're crazy. And I think that you really truly do not need to be crazy to write poems, nor do you need to be miserable. I will say that recently being dumped will always elicit some poems, but not necessarily very good ones. But I think writing from a level of some aspect of calm and sanity is actually a good place to write from.
And one of the discussions I often have with poets, it's a discussion I had with you the last time you were here, mm-hmm. and with poets and fiction writers, short stories and novels, is the notion of whether or not their work is autobiographical.
Yeah.
And one of the characters in a short story in this collection is teaching poetry in a prison, and right. he tells his students, read the poem, not the poet.
Yeah. Well, now he is the quintessential new critic, and it really works well because the hero of that story, D. John Gray, because he knows nothing about Emily Dickinson except that he really, really likes her poems, well, he actually forms a relationship with Emily Dickinson. I have worked with prison writers since the early 80s. So I have been inside the Maryland House of Correction as long as some minor felons. Mostly it's major felons that were there. I really have seen firsthand how men at the Maryland House of Correction for Men, so violent that it was finally closed, so Dickensian that it couldn't be made safe for anybody. But a wonderful place to go in once a week and work with prison writers who learn to love poetry.
On 881, it's Maryland Morning. My guest this morning, Clarinda Harris. Her latest book is a collection of 6 short stories. It's called The White Rail. Tell us about a couple of the other characters in your book. One is Simone, who writes sex-themed cookbooks in a story called The Vinegar Drinker, and she's doing a sort of performance art piece in the old Hutzler's building on mm-hmm. Howard Street. Tell us about her.
By the way, I think it's a great concept, and I recommend it highly. I don't know where she came from. She just emerged. But the one thing you asked about autobiography, the one autobiographical thing was that I wanted to test what vinegar tasted like after reading a wonderful, wonderfully illustrated Bible story book, and I thought it tasted pretty good. So that was really where Simone started. And also, I have to say, I used to practice being a living statue on a hunk of marble at 27th and Charles.
So you would stand there and
pose
in the way that, you know, the 19th century sort of voters did?
Mm-hmm. Right. And that was a very short phase. I don't think I had ever heard of Simon Stylites at the time, but that's where Simone copped her name.
Mm-hmm.
She knew about him. She had been a PhD candidate.
Yes, yeah, Simone is a PhD candidate in English in comparative literature at Hopkins.
Yep.
This is all about Baltimore. All of the settings, you know, are all right in this area. Do you buy the narrative that says Baltimore is quirky and full of characters and eccentric folks?
Oh yeah.
Do you think it's any more full of quirky, eccentric people than Pittsburgh or Denver Detroit?
I can't say. I kind of doubt it. I think maybe it's so very old and it has such a varied history, and even its architecture has its own stories and ghosts.
Let's talk about this story called Bone to Bone, in which the character is Florence Rowland. She's the former poet laureate of the state of Maryland. And you say that this story was in the preface to this story, you say that this was related to you in some form by the great former poet mm-hmm. laureate of the state of Maryland, Lucille Clifton.
Yeah, Lucille Clifton and I were friends, and she gave a number of readings at the Angel Tavern in Fells Point when the late Diane Fancy and I ran a series there that lasted every Sunday for many years. So I got to spend professional and friend time with Lucille Clifton, and she told me about this, and
the crux of the story is that there are two people named Florence Rowland,
right.
and the other Florence Rowland, who isn't a poet, often receives the poet Florence Rowland's mail,
right,
and doesn't return it.
Does in fact refuses it because she is the real Florence Rowland.
Read us a little bit from that story, please.
The other Florence Rowland gets an undisclosed amount of my mail. It is she who won't disclose it, much less turn the mail over to me. I've asked her many times and in many ways, no, never in the one way that might actually force her at least to respond, if only with a look in the eye, a twitch of the cheek. One day or night, I'll do it. I'll simply pause during a reading, look up from my manuscript, and in my clearest public voice, address these words to the pale, immobile face always in the middle of the back row of the hall. Please, I beg you, give me my mail. The pale face used to be huge, bloated-looking, a moonful of pus. It unnerved me when it started showing up at every public performance I gave. This was decades ago, the 70s, 80s. Most of my listeners reacted with laughter or heads-up nods or the occasional semi-embarrassed amen. The moon face never flickered eye or lip. That's why, one afternoon in the late 1980s or so, I sent the manager of Gordon's Booksellers to find out who the face belonged to. The manager came back shaking his head. She says her name is Florence Rowland. I realized she must be the person the post office had delivered my 1989 tax bill to by mistake. I am Florence Rowland of Arbutus Avenue. She is Florence Rowland of Arbor Court, and so on.
And so on. I love the premise of that, you know, that she's getting her mail and shows up to all the poetry readings. And did this actual thing actually happen to Mrs. Clifton?
I don't know whether she ever saw her in person. All I know is that Lucille tried very hard to get her mail back because it's in the story, too. She would get invitations to receive some huge honor and to appear on stage X to receive honor Y. And then people would say, how bizarre. Has she become a complete recluse? Yeah. And she was anything but a recluse.
Of course. Of course. Well, congratulations. I know you've been writing short stories throughout your career. This is the first time you've clumped a few of them together in a book and put it out there. So thanks so much for coming by and talking to us about it.
Thank you, Tom. It was great fun for me to do.
Clarinda Harris, her latest book is a collection of 6 short stories. It's called The White Rail. It's published by Half Moon Editions, and we'll have a link to more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. It's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. Have a great day.
Maryland Morning is an original production of Your Public Radio, WYPR, in Baltimore.
The show is produced by Matt Purdy and Jamila Kay. Nathan Sterner directs and engineers. We have production help from Brandon Block, Alexandra Kennedy, and Justina Latimer.
You can learn more about what you've heard on our show or catch something you've missed on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning.
I'm Tom Hall.
And I'm Sheila Cast. Thanks for listening. See you next time.